Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, in for Rose Aguilar. In July of 2010, President Barack Obama signed what became known as the Dodd-Frank Bill, the 2,300-page legislation aimed to prevent another financial crisis. It was supposed to overhaul the banking system by putting regulatory measures in place, ending the risky bank practices that led to the 2008 crisis, and protecting consumers by creating a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Last month, five federal agencies approved the final version of a key provision of that legislation, the Volcker Rule, which attempts to curtail risky bets by big banks. On January 10th, another part of the legislation will take effect, which will make it harder for buyers to qualify for home mortgages. So how far do these new regulations go to ensure that we don't have another financial crisis? And what's the state of the banking industry today? Five of the largest banks now own 44% of the industry's total assets. They are J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, and U.S. Bank. In 1990, less than 10% of the total industry assets were held by the five largest banks. So today on our Agenda for a New Economy series, we're going to take a look at the banking system, recent reforms, and we'll ask how far we've come since the financial collapse of 2008. And joining us to do that, we've got Jake Bernstein, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He writes for ProPublica, and he joins us from New York. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Holly. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us to explain so much of this complicated stuff. We are also joined by William Black, who's Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He spent years working on regulatory policy and fraud prevention as Executive Director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention, Litigation Director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, and Deputy Director of the National Commission on Financial Institution Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement. Hi, William.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Okay, so Jake, I'm going to have you start us off. Can you just give us a quick recap of what led to the 2008 banking crisis and financial crash?
Sure. We were in a bubble economy, there was a lot of money sloshing around the system, and people were making enough money that it was easy to drown out the voices of concern. And it's one of those things that when the tide goes out, you see who is swimming naked. So what we discovered was that there was really fraud from top to bottom. The way it worked is homeowners were given mortgages that they couldn't necessarily afford. And then those mortgages were in turn packaged into pools of thousands of mortgages by Wall Street, which then sliced and diced those mortgage pools and sold them to investors. Now, so it at different levels, people understood that what they were doing was not entirely proper, but they did it anyway. The regulatory system failed. They became a rubber stamp for the people that they regulated, and just didn't step in and do anything about it.
Thanks. Okay, that's really helpful. And I was wondering, William, if you could maybe explain to us what Glass-Steagall was. Glass-Steagall, I think, was from 1932, 1933, and it separated commercial and investment banking and was finally fully repealed in 1999. Can you explain kind of how that fits into this?
Yes. So in counterpoint to not learning the lessons of the crisis and not doing anything terribly fundamental to deal with the causes of the crisis. In the Great Depression, we had an actual vigorous investigation, the PCORA Commission, and it said one of the two things you said about the need to separate what's called commerce and banking, but it said a second thing as well, and both of these were in the context of Glass-Steagall was also going to bring federal deposit insurance for the first time. Hmm. So they said, if we're going to have federal deposit insurance, it doesn't make any sense to put the Treasury on the hook for banking activities that we don't need to have done by banks that could be done by other entities that wouldn't have deposit insurance. And they said, you know, it doesn't make any sense to give a federal subsidy to one group that's in commerce, say running a big shopping center, competing with another group that's trying to run a shopping center without the federal subsidy of deposit insurance. That would just distort commerce. So for those two reasons, they adopted Glass-Steagall and said, you get to choose. If you want to be in commerce, running things like owning things like shopping centers, great. You get no deposit insurance. You want to be a bank and have depositors protected by the federal treasury, well, then you can only do banking activities. And this had the virtue of working really well for well over 50 years until the largest U.S. banks, the one you were talking about, the four or five largest banks in the United States, went on a jihad. And that lasted at least a decade, in which they first used those regulatory agencies that you just heard about that were hostile to Glass-Steagall to turn it into Swiss cheese on a regulatory basis, and then they finally put it out of its misery, as you said, in the last year and a half of the Clinton administration through what's called Gramm-Leach-Bliley.
And how much do you think how much did that contribute to the financial crisis of 2008?
Well, it's something of a trick question for the reason I just said, because it had been turned into Swiss cheese by hostile regulatory agencies, and that's particularly the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is supposed to regulate the largest banks and hates to do that, and the Federal Reserve, which never regulates effectively, and in particular, Alan Greenspan wanted very badly to kill Glass-Steagall. So even if you hadn't repealed Glass-Steagall, it wouldn't have been terribly effective going into the crisis. And I would say that there are a number of things that Glass-Steagall would have been helpful for, but the largest frauds that Jake was explaining, you could have done even if Glass-Steagall had been in effect.
Well, I want to get into the specifics of the new reforms and ask you what you think is actually effective regulation and how we get there again. But I was really, I guess naively surprised to see how much consolidation has taken place to see that the five of the largest banks now own 44% of the industry's total assets. That's J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, and U.S. Bank. And in 1990, that it was only 10% of the industry assets were held by the largest five banks. So do you mind giving us a quick tutorial, Jake, about this consolidation?
I mean, I think a lot of it began with this deregulation period that Professor Black was talking about, you know, really sort of spearheaded to a large degree by Citigroup, which wanted to be this sort of financial supermarket and do all kinds of different things. And then remarkably enough, after the financial crisis, these banks grew even more as regulators took failed banks and failed financial institutions and pushed them into the arms of these top banks as a way to try to minimize some of the fallout from the financial crisis. But it really it presents a real problem both to the financial system and to regulators, which is, are these institutions so big now that they are A, impossible to regulate, and B, impossible to run correctly, because there are so many different pieces of these banks, so many things going on, so many conflicts inherent in what they do, that it almost becomes humanly impossible to stay on top of it all.
Well, again, we'll get into that in just a sec, but I wanted to ask William, what do you think is good about deregulation?
Well, there are many kinds of deregulation. I personally think it's okay to deregulate the ability to pay higher interest rates than was true of 25 years ago with Reg Q, for example.
With what?
And Well, there was a rule called Reg Q that restricted how much an insured entity could pay deposit holders, but only some deposit holders, and it's very complicated and such. That's an example of a rule that actually had some important purposes, but net probably was good to get rid of. There are many stupid rules. And certainly we during the savings and loan industry, starting the year after the Federal Deregulation Act was passed in 1982, we were already re-regulating the industry. But while we re-regulated, we also got rid of some, large numbers of stupid rules. So there are lots of good things to deregulate, but what you can't deregulate is, again, I think, Jake's central point. We have to, as regulators, serve as the regulatory cops on the beat. And classical economists understood this three centuries ago. You need a rule of law, otherwise the markets will become perverse. And we have become so ideological as a system from UChicago-type beliefs that Greenspan famously said, well, there's no such thing as an unregulated market because the private participants regulated themselves. This is what he has admitted he got completely wrong, and he's finally wised up to what economists knew 300 years ago.
And that's William Black, who's Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's also the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the banking system, recent reforms, and how far we've come since the financial crisis of 2008. We're also joined by Jake Bernstein, who is with ProPublica. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. And so let's talk about the specifics of the new reform. How they're working, what they do. Can you, Jake, give us a little recap of what Dodd-Frank has done?
Sure, or is still doing. I mean, this is a remarkable thing. Dodd-Frank, which was passed went into law almost 3.5 years ago, it has 398 separate rules in it that have to be, enacted and figured out, and the regulators have to put into force. And of those 398 rules, only about 165 have been finalized. Hmm. That's just over 40%. And that's 3.5 years later. So this is very much a work in progress. It does all kinds of different things, as you would imagine a piece of legislation that is thousands of pages long. One of the things it does is what you alluded to. It creates this new thing called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is up and running and seems to be doing a fairly good job. It's also created something called the Volcker Rule, which was part of Dodd-Frank. The Volcker Rule doesn't allow banks to trade on their own accounts, so they can't do a lot of the speculative stuff that they used to do in the past. But unfortunately, and we can talk about this later, there are some giant holes in that rule.
And the American Bankers Association is filing motions against it to suspend parts of it.
Yes, they're particularly concerned at the moment about some effects that it will have on smaller banks, on community banks. But what's interesting about the Volcker Rule is that there are a number of exceptions, and what it really comes down to, and what so much of this comes down to, a slight digression, is that you could make a strong argument that the tools to prevent the last financial crisis already existed. That if regulators had been more aggressive in enforcing the rules on the books, the existing rules on the books, they could have prevented the financial crisis. They did not do that. So there's an argument that even with more rules, it still comes down to the regulatory culture that exists. Are the regulators willing to aggressively enforce this stuff? And they might be a little bit more willing now as the economy is still weak and we are still relatively close to the financial crisis. But if there's a new bubble or if the economy starts roaring again, the pressure will increase for them to back off. And there's no indication that the culture has changed enough that they won't do that again.
And William, who are these regulators and why did they fail?
Well, I agree, first, that there were completely adequate rules to prevent the crisis. And so we it's critical to distinguish between what we call the three Ds: deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization. And obviously they can all work together. But deregulation is what it sounds like. But what Jake was just describing is desupervision. And that is, the rules can be there, but the people don't believe in the rules, don't believe in enforcing them, don't believe fraud can occur, and therefore they refuse to do so. And the classic thing that your listeners can take a look at can be found in the 2003 annual report of the FDIC, because they were so proud of this. We call it the Chainsaw Gillerin picture, because the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision is standing next to the three leading bank lobbyists in America and the deputy director of the FDIC. The Office of Thrift Supervision head is holding a chainsaw, and everybody else has the huge cutting shears that you use to, you know, take down inch-thick limbs and such, and they are poised and posed over a pile of federal regulations. And the message is, we are working hand in glove with the industry to destroy all regulation, and we're not going to be careful about it because the chainsaw is not exactly a surgical instrument for these purposes. So that was the mindset, and they, you can recall that they also appointed the leading opponent of securities regulation in America to be the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Well, you're not going to get effective supervision in these circumstances. And as Jake alluded to earlier, we need to talk about the fact that the largest banks are completely ungovernable, unsupervisable. You can't even examine them effectively. So, and of course, we have de facto decriminalization to an extent we've never seen, where there is still not a single elite Wall Streeter who actually caused the crisis that's even being prosecuted, much less in prison. So none of those things have been done. In particular, the Fed had the express authority under a law passed in 1994 called HOEPA, the Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act, to stop liars' loans. And people begged from the, you know, even some members of the industry, but mostly public interest types and regulators begged Greenspan to use that authority. He refused. Bernanke refused to use that authority. Finally used it in July of 2008, only under intense congressional pressure. You may note that July 2008 is just a little late. And even then, he delayed the effective date of the rule for 15 months because you wouldn't want to inconvenience a fraudulent lender. So that's the kind of supervisors we had at the top levels of government, and they made this crisis inevitable.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the 2008 banking financial crisis and banking reforms, and we're asking how far we've come. I want to invite you to join our conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Do you think we need more regulation of the financial industry? Are the banks too big to fail or succeed? What do you think should be done about this? And what do you want to know about banking reform and the banking system and the financial solvency of our system? You can email us questions at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. So, Jake, is anyone calling for the big banks to be broken up? Is that something that is being contemplated, or is that just off the table entirely?
There are a few lonely voices who are calling for it. but nothing even approaching a quorum. So it's not really on the table at this point. And I think that one approach that some are sort of advocating is just to sort of layer on so much regulation and increased capital requirements that it'll eventually make it too painful, that there will be a tax on bigness that will be severe enough that the banks will begin to understand that it's in their interest to slim down. But I find it unlikely that that will happen, just because of economies of scale and there are advantages, particularly hidden subsidies for banks of these sizes. I don't see them getting smaller. If anything, they might get larger.
Well, and the news today is of the J.P. Morgan settlement in the Madoff case, that they're going to pay $1.7 billion. How much have banks paid in fines and suits, and are they being held accountable for fraud and failures that led to the 2008 crisis in any way?
Well, first, banks don't exist, right? A bank has never cried because Wall Street had a power shovel hit it or something like that. Only humans get to make decisions. And the people that make the decisions, the CEOs and the CFOs, have won spectacularly. They have been made wealthier, and this is, in fact, pushed income inequality to record levels in the United States. So the answer is fraud, elite fraud in finance pays enormously. And once you do see a settlement, you note that it's not the individuals paying these settlements. It is almost exclusively these settlements are being paid by the banks, which, of course, are entities in which the shareholders are going to bear that cost. So it's sort of a triple whammy from the CEO standpoint. First, they enrich themselves through the compensation and caused a tremendous loss to the shareholders through their frauds. And now, even when they get caught, what happens is not a penny, it looks like, of the J.P. Morgan senior executives is being clawed back, but the shareholders are getting it nailed again. So they got nailed for the losses. They got nailed for paying the massive compensation for fraudulent behavior by their executives, and now they get nailed when they get caught.
So who ultimately pays that then?
Mostly shareholders, but a lot of this stuff, although apparently not the one you just mentioned, Madoff, a healthy dose of this is actually transferred to the U.S. Treasury because most of these settlements are actually tax deductible.
And Jake, it sounded like you wanted to get in. We just have about a minute before the break, so go ahead.
Sure. I mean, ironically, once these settlements are announced, the share prices of these companies usually go up, because everyone sort of breathes a sigh of relief that it's all over. And they have also they have quite extensive litigation reserves, so they've put aside money to pay for these things. So ultimately, it doesn't really affect the bottom line or hinder the bank particularly.
That's Jake Bernstein. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for ProPublica. He's joining us from New York. We've also got William Black on the line. He's Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he's the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're talking about banking reform, what's happened since the financial crisis of 2008, and are we protected from another financial collapse along those lines. If you want to join our discussion, the number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. We also have information and links to all of the information that we're talking about and our guests' work at yourcallradio.org. And you can join us and ask any questions that you have about the financial system and its solvency, 866-798-TALK. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You you'd like to add your voice to today's discussion, the number is 866-798-TALK. You can also email us feedback@yourcallradio.org or just post your comment at yourcallradio.org. Half past 10 o'clock is the time. Coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today, the conversation picks up where they left off yesterday with militants in charge of the Iraqi city of Fallujah. World Have Your Say, coming up at 11, here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, why are so many people still poor in America? We're marking the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, which included programs like food stamps and unemployment insurance. But the poverty rate has only fallen from 19 to 15% in half a century, and children remain at the highest risk. So did the war on poverty fail? What were the enduring successes? And how do people move out of poverty to attain economic mobility? Thursday, we'll examine Common Core, the new educational standards. Today, we're looking at banking reform, its history, the new Volcker Rule, and how it will affect the financial industry. We're also talking about regulation, how banks are regulated and what works and what doesn't. You can join our conversation. I'll give out the number in a minute. We've got full lines right now. We're speaking with Jake Bernstein, who's an investigative reporter with ProPublica, and William Black, who's associate professor of economics and law, and he is the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Let's go straight to our callers. We've got a lot of people who want to talk to you. George in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hi, good morning. You know, some time ago, you can remember perhaps there were these voices that we would hear that said, we've got to get our hands on the Social Security Trust. If we only could break open that trust. Were these voices of people who were attempting to gain control of the assets of the Social Security system so they could toss them into the bonfire that you've been describing? And if there's any connection between that and what you've described so far, are those people still around, possibly looking for another opportunity to break open the Social Security Trust?
Absolutely, they're the same people, and absolutely they're around. It's Pete Peterson and Third Way and a whole bunch of other groups that right now are running around college campuses urging college students to declare war on the people around my age, you know, in their early 60s and such. And their greatest single goal is to get a hold of Social Security, privatize it, and turn that into a source of fees for Wall Street, and that's the same people who are the leading proponents of the disastrous austerity policies as well. But the point is, of course, they're very powerful in both major political parties. The Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party has been ascendant in presidential politics for at least 20 years.
And let's go to another caller. John in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Good morning. I'm glad this issue has not been forgotten, Holly. Thank you for having this program.
Absolutely.
As I was waiting to come on the line, I just punched in the incarceration rates in the world. And I find that the United States is at the very top, ahead of Russia, China, all of the totalitarian governments in the world. The U.S. has the most people, almost by far,
yeah,
than any other country. Yet, we didn't put anybody in jail as a result of the massive fraud that caused the worst economic crisis since the Depression. So my question is, it's a two-pronged question, would we be better off if some of our prison population included the people who were responsible for that massive fraud? And the second part of the question is, why didn't the Obama administration file criminal charges against those people? Were they afraid or intimidated, or were they in cahoots with those people.
Were they the very same people? Yeah, go ahead.
I think we would certainly be in better shape if there had been more accountability. You know, if bankers thought that there would be real personal repercussions for their activities instead of this sort of diffuse,
fines
funded by shareholders. But I also I think that there are a number of different reasons why there weren't more prosecutions. One of the top people of the Department of Justice said, and this is extraordinary, in a speech that he stayed up at night worrying that if he did more prosecutions against these firms, that it would hurt the economy, that it would throw people out of their jobs, and he didn't want to do that. So there were all kinds of concerns about the economy that were governing this. There were also issues of the law. There was a sense that it's kind of fuzzy, and it's a lot of this stuff was clearly immoral, but was it actually illegal? Particularly when you get higher up into these Wall Street firms, and then it's very hard to make cases that convince juries that in fact people, because remember for criminal cases, you need intent. You need intent to defraud. It's hard to make those cases. So there were a variety of different reasons why there weren't more prosecutions. But I think ultimately the main reason was that there wasn't the focus to do that. There weren't resources that were put into it. There was lots of talk by DOJ about task force and things like that. But as Bill can talk about, there was nothing commensurate with the amount of resources and manpower that was thrown at the savings and loan crisis.
Yeah, so let's have Bill talk about that, because it seems that there was an extraordinary opportunity here for reform, for accountability. What happened, Bill?
Well, fundamentally, the president of the United States, the incoming president, decided that he would not use FDR as his model and try to be a really transformational president. And so the first answer, of course, is that big finance is the leading political contributor to both parties. But here's what people, now speaking as someone who was heavily involved in the prosecutions, in the savings and loan debacle, and who is a white-collar criminologist. What people don't understand about elite white-collar crimes of this nature is, first, they're run by CEOs. Second, banks don't make criminal referrals against their own CEOs. Third, we have roughly two FBI agents who do white-collar crime per industry in the United States. Not per corporation, per industry. And that means that they don't have expertise in the industry, and that means they can't possibly walk a beat. They only investigate if there's a criminal referral, which is not going to come from the bank. So it can only come in any significant numbers from the regulators. In the savings and loan crisis, our agency, which regulated savings and loans, made over 30,000 criminal referrals. And we got this produced over 1,000 felony convictions just in cases designated as major, and we hyper-prioritized the cases so that we went after the absolute most elite 600. Nearly all of them were prosecuted, and we had a 90% conviction rate. Despite all the difficulties, Jake is correct. These are very difficult cases to make. Flash forward to this crisis, which is 70 times larger than the savings and loan crisis, and the fraud is more than 70 times larger than the savings and loan crisis. And the same agency that I was talking about made zero criminal referrals in this crisis. And that appears to be true of the Fed and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency as well, and the FDIC was smart enough to refuse to answer the question.
The regulators are not going to refer cases that they miss themselves.
It seems outrageous, though. I know I'm being naive here, but it really just doesn't make any sense.
Oh, it is one of the greatest scandals in all of history. As a former Justice Department lawyer, I would tell you it is the greatest strategic failure, far greater than 9/11, in the history of the Justice Department. It is a complete destruction of our theory of the system of justice. Lanny Brewer's comments, which is what Jake was quoting about staying up at night and wanting the other side to send economists, giving him an excuse not to prosecute, is an obscenity. It will produce all the worst conceivable incentives, and it's actually worse than the caller thinks, because he's quite right about the massive over-incarceration in the United States of minor crimes. There are thousands of people in prison because of fraud in this crisis, and they're all small players.
You know, a prevalent attitude on Wall Street pre-crisis was this idea that, you know, I know what I'm doing is improper, but if this really goes south, everybody is going to get caught up in it. So I'm not going to have to suffer the consequences, because what I'm doing is just what everyone else is doing. And so it's going to be bad for everybody, and it'll all just get washed out. And that, in fact, proved to be true. There wasn't very much accountability at all, because so many people were involved in it.
Because everybody was a conspirator. Yeah, go ahead, William.
So your listeners might want to read what we've been writing about a Gresham's dynamic. And this is something in economics and criminology in which bad ethics drives good ethics out of the marketplace. And that is how you get all AAA rating for complete toxic waste. That is how you get overwhelmingly inflated appraisals on homes. That's why you get an incidence of fraud in liar's loans. This is fraud overwhelmingly from the lenders, by the way, that the lender's own experts put at 90%, and that this is why you get surveys of appraisers that show that by 2006, 90% of all the appraisers in the United States had personally been extorted just that calendar year by the lenders to inflate appraisals. Now, think about that. No honest lender would ever inflate an appraisal. So you get these two largest and most destructive financial waves of fraud in the loan origination process in world history. That's the liar's loans and the appraisal fraud. And then there's no fraud exorcist. So when you sell it to the secondary market, you can't say, "Hi, I want to sell you a fraudulent loan." So you have to make a fraudulent reps and warranties. And so that's the third stage. And by the way, the Justice Department and its task force only look at the third stage, where it's banks cheating other banks. They don't look at the first two stages, where it's banks cheating people. They don't even investigate it.
That's William Black. He's Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Cronin. We're talking about the financial crisis of 2008, what led up to it, and what the reforms since then have been. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. You can ask all of your questions about the collapse and the reforms since 866-798-8255, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Jake Bernstein is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for ProPublica. He's also on the line with us. And what do you think is the best way to reform and regulate the financial industry? How does it affect you? If you are in the banking industry, what's your perspective on this? 866-798-8255. I'm going to get to a couple of callers right now, but Armand writes in and he says, "I'm under the impression that another crash is inevitable. Is this true or likely?"
Yes.
I wish I could say with confidence that it's not. I tend to agree with Bill on this and think that it is probably inevitable. I don't think we've learned the lessons. I think a big key is this lack of accountability and the fact that so much of this is going to be based on the subjective decision-making of the regulators, and the dynamics have not changed very much. So I think if there's a new bubble, then, yeah, it's probably inevitable that we'll have another crisis.
Let's go to Mahadevan in Oakland. Hi. Welcome to your call.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This has been a most informative and intelligent discussion. I appreciate it. My question is perhaps a little bit peripheral to the topic, but it has to do with the Glass-Steagall Act. What I'd like from your guests as an immigrant, you know, I wasn't here, obviously, when that was passed. To give some perspective, what was different historically in the United States when that act was passed, and then in, put it into the modern context, today's context, and try and explain to us why, with the will of the people behind it, we won't be able to, you know, recreate an act like that. And also comment on the irony that, if I'm not mistaken, it was a Democrat, Clinton, who oversaw the dismantling of that most useful and valuable act. Thank you.
All right, so Mahadevan brings up the Glass-Steagall Act again. Go ahead, William.
Okay, so the key things again are that bankers had been thoroughly discredited after the Great Depression instead of massive bailouts going to them. This was because of the investigation of the PCORA Commission. By the way, the first two investigation efforts failed, but PCORA was the real deal, not a banking expert, but someone expert in dealing with a mob, which turned out to be very good in terms of his investigative skills. He put the facts in the record. The public was horrified. And if people will recall, FDR said, you know, the bankers hate me and I revel in their hate. Can you imagine a modern U.S. president saying anything like this? It is not an irony that Bill Clinton was very pro-finance because Bill Clinton was a leader of the Democratic leadership, the DLC, and its express goal was to move the party. And one of the ways it wanted to move the party was into a partnership with finance, which was viewed as progressive in some social sense. And it was, of course, viewed as a major source of campaign funding. And finance has become astonishingly dominant in the United States, as it did, by the way, just before the Great Depression, where once more, under some measures, 40% of total corporate profits go to this one sector, finance.
Yeah, I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We've got a lot of questions from people emailing us, but let's go to Tom. Tom in San Francisco, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you for taking my call. We've heard a little bit about community banks. North Dakota has the state bank that's over 100 years old. It makes a lot of sense. Couldn't San Francisco have a community bank that could actually grow into, say, the San Francisco Bay Area Community Bank, where we could have a little bit, you know, more safeguards than what's going on with a fraud industry? Thank you.
So how much could community banks that are ideally more receptive to their constituencies, how much could they be a solution to this?
I think community banks got swept up into this as well. I mean, one of the big sort of killers of banks and what really caused the spike in bank failures after the financial crisis was commercial lending, and really bad commercial lending. They fell under the sway of developers, and they wanted to grow their balance sheets. I mean, community banks can be very susceptible to the blandishments of Wall Street and have dreams of becoming bigger banks. So I'm not entirely sure that size is necessarily the answer.
But you do think accountability is one of the answers. Here's an email from KJ. Could either of your guests envision a scenario where U.S. banks, in order to avoid insolvency, declare that their depositors are shareholders and thus confiscate depositors' accounts, as was recently done in Cyprus? William?
No, but I will tell you that the latest darling idea in conservative economics is to have a broad new class of debt that would swing and become equity if there was a crisis. And this is not this is still a really ideological effort to say we don't need no stinking regulation. We'll just change it so that private parties exercise the discipline. And if they adopt it, it will actually make banks much more likely to fail.
And here are two follow-up related questions. Do your guests consider FDIC an adequate protection for bank depositors' accounts?
Well, ironically, I think the FDIC has been, you know, slightly better regulator than the other regulators, in part because they have money on the line. They are an insurance fund, and so they don't want to lose that money, and they're a little bit more aggressive than the other regulators have been in the past. So, I think that your money is probably the insurance money. I mean, it would have to be quite catastrophic for people not to get paid back that minimum insurance.
And so maybe you've already answered this. Sarah writes, how does an ordinary person who has investments and savings protect his or herself under present circumstances of bank megapower and government passivity? Go ahead, William.
Yeah, so the real protection is that the Treasury stands behind the FDIC, and the Treasury, we have a sovereign currency. So you're not going to lose money in a savings account as long as you stay under the insurance limits, and the insurance limits these days are very large. So normal human beings, that's not an issue at all. That isn't where your concern should be, but your concern should be, we've been talking about hyperconcentration. What we haven't told you is what started all this discussion. You wanted to know about the Volcker Rule and Glass-Steagall. Well, the concentration in financial derivatives is not 40% of total assets. It is 94% of all U.S. financial derivatives are traded annually by the four largest banks that do derivatives. And financial derivatives are massively greater than the real economy, and they're overwhelmingly off-book.
Go ahead, Jake.
And I just wanted to add that, remember, earlier in the conversation I talked about how the vast majority of the Dodd-Frank rules have not been enacted.
Right.
Well, the vast majority of those rules that have not been enacted concern derivatives.
So you said that there are 398 separate rules and only, what, 165 have gone into effect?
Yeah, so that's as of December.
I want to squeeze in as many callers as I can, but can I just get a quick, brief assessment from each of you of the effectiveness of Dodd-Frank?
Doesn't deal with any of the fundamental causes, and that's why that we're going to have future crises. It has a number of good provisions. The one you've talked about, the Volcker Rule, because they have been unwilling to go back to Glass-Steagall. They're going to continue to allow banks be in commerce. It's going to be unenforceable because the four banks that I've talked about in derivatives are so massive, you can call anything they do a hedge against something in their literally $1.5 trillion portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a mixed bag. I think there are some really good things that came out of it, particularly the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and some other aspects of it. But ultimately, I don't think it's going to do the job. It probably was not exactly the right approach.
All right, let me try and squeeze in a couple more callers. Ken in San Francisco, welcome to your call. Can you please try and be brief?
Yes, you've touched on it, and people do get lost in the complex technical language. So, was there ever any proposal to reverse Bill Clinton's passage of the Commodities Futures Trading Law, passed in 2000? And just to dumb it down and make it simple for folks, it's the law that created unregulated derivatives trading, otherwise known as junk bonds, which got rated AAA.
All right, so let's get an answer to that, Ken. Thanks. Is there any discussion about reversing the Commodities Futures Trading Act?
You knew that the Dodd-Frank bill was very badly designed when it didn't have a single sentence that said the Commodities Future Modernization Act and Graham Leach Bliley are repealed.
Right. I mean, there's the Dodd-Frank has a lot of rules and regulations about derivatives, but no, it's not a repeal of the act.
So I apologize that we're not going to get to as many callers as I'd like. Let's try to get to Steve in Santa Cruz. Welcome to your call. Please be brief.
Yes. I'm being sued by Chase Bank for a house that they have no documentation of owning. And when I got the original loan from WaMu, They told me to get it in my wife's name because her credit score was higher, and so I did that. And now, all these years later, I'm being sued by another bank for a house with no there's no recorded document that says they have a right to it.
Let's see if we can get some advice for Steve in Santa Cruz. Jake or William?
I'm not going to give legal advice over a phone.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to know more about it.
It does get to this question of accountability. People who are mortgage holders are certainly being held to account.
We have not talked about a massive problem and the whole MERS system that has created gratuitously, just to escape of some few taxes, a cloud on people's title in ways that is grotesquely irresponsible. You need a program, perhaps, on all of MERS.
We'll continue to do programs on these things, and I'll follow up with both of you to get suggestions on how to continue to cover this. But can we try and end on what can we do, those of us who are listening, who are alarmed by this, who don't want another financial crisis, what can we be doing? Jake and then William.
I mean, I know it sounds trite, but you have to use the political system. You have to contact your representatives and tell them how you feel and tell them what your expectations are. Not enough people do that. So that's one big issue. And then you have a certain degree of power, financial power, in the choices that you make about what institutions you decide to support. That's another piece of it. But it's hard to make a difference.
And William, just 30 seconds, what can we do?
Pick one thing, and the one thing I would pick is the systemically dangerous institutions. Contrary to what Jake said, there are not economies of scale. In fact, there are severe diseconomies. In other words, these things are inefficient, they're dangerous. When they blow up, and not if, but when they blow up, they'll cause a global crisis, and they destroy, affect any ability to have real competition, and they create crony capitalism. So they're 0 for 4. We should get rid of them.
All right, and we'll continue to cover this. We do Agenda for a New Economy every Tuesday. On Your Call, you heard from William Black, who's Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Jake Bernstein is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for ProPublica. We'll put links to all of this information at yourcallradio.org. You can also continue to post information there and continue this conversation. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Why are so many people still poor in America? On the next Your Call, we'll mark the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, which included programs like food stamps and unemployment insurance. But the poverty rate has only fallen from 19 to 15% in half a century. So did the War on Poverty fail? What were the enduring successes? And how do people move out of poverty to attain economic mobility? It's Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.